to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some small way. And you may already know from our last few episodes, but a reminder that we are remote recording now, and I'm recording from my bedroom, so yes, you might hear the cat. Yes, you might hear some birds outside. I live in LA. That's what's going on. The audio is likely going to sound a little different from our studios, but everything else is the same. And today, the thing that is different is that the guest we have is writer-director Crystal Moselle. Hi, Crystal.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Are you in New York right now?
I am. I'm in New York. Oh. I'm on my couch with my cat. Well, the cat that I've borrowed.
You can just borrow cats in New York? Is that...
Well, I put a little thing on Facebook. I said, I am looking to borrow a cat. I'm feeling a bit lonely. And somebody replied and said, my boyfriend is allergic to cats and my cat needs a home while we're quarantined together. So,
oh, wow. That's so cool. Well, hi, Isabel. For those of you who are less familiar with Crystal's work, now you know that she has a cat, but let me give you a full bio so you can refresh on her. She's a New York-based director and is a storyteller of both documentary and fiction films. She is best known for her Sundance Grand Jury Prize award-winning documentary, The Wolf Pack, which was later distributed by Magnolia Pictures. Crystal discovered the Angulo. Is it Angulo? I can never remember how to pronounce their name.
Angulo.
Okay, so she discovered the Angulo brothers, who were the subjects of the documentary On the Streets of New York. In the past, she worked on short-form projects with publications such as the New York Times, Vice, and Nowness. After the success of the Wolf Pack, she met a group of female skateboarders on the train, who would later become her main collaborators and subjects on three projects. The first was a narrative short called That One Day, which she produced in collaboration with Miu Miu and saw its premiere at the 73rd Venice International Film Festival. Shortly after that, they expanded the film into a feature which Crystal co-wrote and directed, named after the infamous group Skate Kitchen. The feature premiered at Sundance 2018 and was later distributed by Magnolia to critical acclaim. In the same year, Crystal was nominated for the Breakthrough Director Award at the Gotham Awards for her direction of the film. Her third collaboration with the skaters is the upcoming HBO series Betty, a 6-episode comic drama show following the ups and downs of the larger-than-life characters from the film. So, Crystal, yes. The movie that you chose to talk about today is Sexy Beast.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your favorite genre films? Because I was a little bit surprised, but I'm also very excited to dig into it and its differences from the way that, you know, you've crafted things so far.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it couldn't be any more different than the way that I make films. But I don't know. I just always have loved this film. From the first time I saw it, I think I was in California. I went to see a film and I was in the wrong theater. And I realized 15 minutes in that it was the wrong movie and it was Sexy Beast. And I had no idea what they were saying. I still watch it with subtitles just so I can understand a little bit more.
I do too. It adds a lot more when you watch it with subtitles. You're like, oh, that's what it was. Oh, okay.
Yes. And also you think they say different things than they say, and you're like, oh, that's okay. Got it. And, but what I really love about it is that I love when you fall into a story almost like it feels like you fell into the happy ending. Like this old gangster dude who's like this, mm-hmm. British guy, he's living the life that he always planned for. And he has like, it's almost like he's with this family and he has this perfect life. And the family is him and his lady and his best friend and his lady. And they have like this, it's like this family that they've created, and it's like the perfect life for him. So it builds so much tension along the narrative of the film because you just want him to get back to that perfect life, and everything mm-hmm. just keeps fucking it up. I think Gal is like my dream man. Like, I want to live.
Just a sun-baked thief.
Yeah. I want to live in the hills of like, where are they, like Ibiza or something? They're like, they never say exactly where they're at, but I'm pretty sure that's where it is. And they're like live in a villa. It's beautiful. They're like just chill. They have like the nice little like pool boy who's like fun and, you know, it's great. And he's in love. And like, you can tell, like, he probably fell in love like later on in his life. And like, you know, it's like the story of like, for me, it's like inspiring. I'm turning 40 this year. I'm like, oh, I could have like a future like this. This is my future. I love it. And then this
Crystal,
then,
I love that this is your inspiration. It's like hashtag life goals, sexy beast. Yeah.
Like I don't have any kids. Like I'm ready for that life.
Well, let's get into it. I'm going to give a quick synopsis. But first, for those of you who haven't seen Sexy Beast, today's episode is obviously going to give you some spoilers. That shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Sexy Beast, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Sexy Beast with a full synopsis. Written by Lewis Mellis and David Cinto and directed by Jonathan Glazer for release in 2001, Sexy Beast stars Ray Winston as Gal, the aforementioned Gal that Crystal was talking about, a retired criminal who spends his days sunbathing by his pool on the Spanish coast.
I'm sweating here. Roasting. Boiling. Biking.
One day, a boulder rolls down a hill and almost kills him before landing in the pool and smashing the bottom tile. It's a harbinger of bad things to come, further exacerbated by Gal's bad dreams of a demonic rabbit hunting him down in the desert. Gal and his wife, Dee, I always forget about that part. Gal and his wife, Dee Dee, are also entertaining their friends, Ike and his wife, Jackie. All seems well until Jackie shows up to dinner with a face as white as a sheet. Gal thinks the couple's just having a fight, but it turns out Jackie is terrified because an old criminal friend of theirs, Don Logan, played by Ben Kingsley, has just called and he's on the way to Spain to enlist Gal for another heist job.
Tell him what the fuck you like. Tell him anything.
You can tell him yourself. Yeah.
He's coming over.
Tomorrow.
It's immediately apparent that everyone is terrified of Don. Don arrives, and he's a bulldozer of a human being, but Gal says he doesn't want to do another job. The life gave him more emotional turmoil than he'd ever let on, and he's happy now.
Look, Don.
Look, Don.
It's like this.
Like what?
Retired.
Are ya?
Afraid so. I haven't not got lots of money yet. I've got enough. I'll do anything not to offend you. But I can't take part. I'm not really up to it.
Still, Don hangs out at the house, a menace to their idyllic life. When Gal suggests maybe Don only came because he wanted to see Jackie, he'd slept with her before, Don demands to be taken to the airport. But Don's also ejected from his plane for being an asshole and not putting out his cigarette and just being generally terrible.
Your cigarette. You have to put it out.
Cigarette? What? This? No, I'm not going to put it out.
You must.
What's that?
If you don't, we can't take off.
Well, that's your problem, isn't it?
Don returns to the house to everyone's surprise and terror and tries to jackhammer Gal into doing the job. In a fit of rage, he says he's going to kill Gal and smashes a bottle over Gal's head, incapacitating him. We see Dee Dee pull a gun, and then we're swept to a later time with Gal in rainy London, where the heist boss, Teddy, is questioning Gal about Don's whereabouts. He's gone missing.
Where's Don, Gal? He never left Spain, Gal, I know that. He never got on a plane. Well, he did. And he got off again. And there's no record of him getting another flight. I can only assume he's still in Spain.
So Gal says he doesn't know and participates in the heist. Everything goes as planned, drilling through a sauna pool in the bank vaults next door. Flashbacks reveal, though, that Dee Dee shot Don, and then all of them got their piece of flesh until Don was dead. Gal pockets some earrings from the job, gets paid £10 for his work. Teddy knew Gal killed Don, and that's his kind of ransom for it, and returns home a happy man. except for the telltale heart of Don buried under Gal's pool, that is, and it's apparently just going to haunt him, and he'll just be sunbathing for the rest of his life listening to Don shit talk him.
Told you you'd do the job.
Yeah, well, you were right, Don. Technically speaking, you were right. But you're dead. So shut up.
So that's about it. I want to talk about career directions. This was Jonathan Glazer's debut feature, and he had already been directing a ton of music videos and a ton of commercials. He'd kind of mastered the short form, and especially an experimental short form. And for some bands he was working with, he was going into more narrative space. You can see a lot of that with what he was doing with like Karma Police for Radiohead and some other videos of the 90s at that time and early 2000s. But he said, quote, "I wanted to get into films for 3 or 4 years, but I wanted to get to a point of control where I was in a position where I could get the most out of the material I was making, rather than do a studio project just for the sake of it. Because I'm definitely developing this work myself, which is taking up most of my time right now. Feature films I definitely want to concentrate on because it's what I enjoy most, but there's a lot of interesting experimentation that you can have with commercials and music videos. So even someone like Ridley Scott would go back and do a commercial from time to time. So there's merit beyond the obvious financial benefit," end quote. I think for him, he was talking a lot about the kind of obstacles to creativity and originality that you might have for feature films, especially if they're not independently financed. And I think, he's probably right about that. He had the means to wait. He was making quite a bit of money doing music videos and commercials. So that was an obvious benefit. But, I think you can tell in this film that he had more control over it than so many debut filmmakers will ever have. First, I would like to talk about the fact of how long do you long to be a feature filmmaker, but you are doing other things because you feel like you should, hone a craft or get more power to the point where you can ask for what you want and actually get it?
I mean, for me, I worked in commercials and making fashion films for many years, like maybe like 6 years, 7 years. Mm-hmm. And the documentary, Wolfpack, really just fell in my lap because I met those guys on the street. And it was a real instinct that I had when I met them. And I think that's I really learned about my instinct through the process of making that film, because I didn't even know I was making a film when I was working with them. I had I had several scripts that I was writing. And I think a lot of, short form directing is finding your voice, because I was making these fashion films that nobody would recognize my work if they saw them now. They're actually very choreographed. My early work was very choreographed, and I just fell into that type of work from, filming behind the scenes of photo shoots, and then a brand would hire me to actually make their film. And I worked with Kate Spade, and it was more choreographed, more rhythmic, more timed out. And then making the Wolfpack set me free because I was just able to run around with the camera and do exactly what I felt. And I think I really formed my style through that process.
I think that maybe that might be a reason that you connect with Sexy Beast. You can see these kinds of maybe origins of what you were working in previously, this appreciation of that.
I love finding kind of the connections in films. There's the whole thing with the pool at Gal's house, and the two hearts in the pool, representing his perfect honeymoon love that's going to last mm-hmm. forever. And then when he goes on the heist, they have to break through a pool, which is represents pain and the devil. And they almost get electrocuted, and it's the complete opposite. So it's like, I feel like there's like a real play between like darkness and lightness between the two worlds. And like in his world, like with his, like, you know, with his friends, like they're like happy and laughing at dinner. And there's like this like real, like kind of bougie, sweet, like, you know, he's this gentleman and, you know, they have their ladies and stuff. And then when you're like in the heist world, there's like just like close-ups of all these like men with like fucked up teeth laughing. Like, it, I don't know. I just love the kind of just like playing like the parallels. And I don't know, there's just like really great details that I love to like look at and like kind of like see the, like the representation of them.
I mean, this is something that we can get into too, because the art department on this had a huge, huge job for what the actual budget was for this. We need to take a quick break. So what we do, we'll come back and then we can talk a little bit about the art department. I want to get into some of the performances too, and a little bit more about this choreography that you're talking about, because you're onto something, and he's got some really great quotes about this. So we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jackie Cation.
Hi, I'm Lori Kilmartin.
And we have a podcast called The Jackie and Lori Show. Who are you, Lori Kilmartin?
Oh my God, so much pressure. I'm a stand-up. I've been doing stand-up since 1987. I'm a writer for Conan. I've written a couple books, have a couple CDs out, have a special out. Who are you, Jackie?
Well, I too am a stand-up comic since 1984. And I do the road like a maniac and don't have a cool writing job, but I have 4 albums out, working on a new album. We talk about stand-up. We talk about all the different parts of stand-up comedy. So that's the Jackie and Lori Show, and you should subscribe on Maximum Fun if you want to hear that.
And I would encourage you not to.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Crystal Moselle in New York, and we're talking about Sexy Beast. This is technically a heist movie, but it's not a heist movie. And Glazer said, quote, "He looks like he did the gangster stuff before," talking about Gal. In a way, it was trying to be a film that wasn't about a gangster. When the film finally goes to London, it doesn't want to go to London. It doesn't suddenly become Rafifi. It doesn't become a big heist movie. It's trying to say, don't worry, we're taking an intermission in this trip to England. We'll be back to Spain before you know it. And that was key. It's very hard to have a film about a heist and avoid making a heist movie, end quote. But that also encapsulates one of the reasons why I love it so much, is because you think that you're getting into, oh, he's going to convince him to come and do this heist, and then you're going to do the heist and it's going to be building the team or doing this other stuff, but it's not that at all. It's a personal drama about a guy who just wants to stay with his beautiful wife and his beautiful home.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's why I love the film so much, because it takes you on that journey, but it's an emotional journey, really. Like, you could care less about, and when he makes no money at the end, you're like, fine, great, just fucking bring me back to my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I can probably relate that to, in some way, I would say Skate Kitchen, and you know, also Betty, in the sense that you are doing a movie that has skate in the title, and yes, there's skating in it, but it's not about a kind of, you know, like, competition in a way. It's not like a skate film, you know. There's such a long history of skate films, but that's not what you're doing. Skating is very clearly part of the milieu that you're presenting, but it's more about the personal relationships and those dramas.
Yeah, actually, one day that we were shooting Skate Kitchen, now we didn't lose a day because we shot it, but we ended up cutting it out. The narrative was a bit different, where there was a whole like skate contest, and you know, one of the girls gets hurt and everything. And I think we had like 400 extras. We had like Alyssa Steamer, who's like a famous skateboarder woman there, and all these people. And then we ended up cutting it out. So, you know, it just got too big. I think sometimes like, you know, when like you're in the writer's room, because like for Betty, we're in the writer's room, and you're making these pitches, and you'll say like, oh, like bad pitch, I have this idea. And the bad pitch is just really, it's like the sentiment of the idea. You're like, okay, bad pitch, like she meets like some dude on the street and falls in love, but like it like, you know, you're trying to like actually figure out like, what is this connective tissue that's going to bring us to the next moment? But like you have like the bad idea, but then you come up with a good idea that's in place for the bad idea. Yes. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah.
Because you need to know the impulse of what you're supposed to do before you realize the impulse of what you should do, which is fighting against the should.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the bad pitch was like actually filmed with like 300, 400 people and brought to the edit. And then in the edit, we're like, this isn't working. We just need them to go skating together and for her just to get hurt while they're skating, trying to skate like a bigger trick or whatever. So it was kind of funny. But I think those are like the moments that you really learn about. Like, I mean, that was like a good lesson for me to learn about other ideas for, you know, other projects. Like, it's like, sometimes I have to take a look and be like, does this feel too big for my story? Like, can we just bring, like, what's like the emotional connection in the story? That's like, what is the meaningful emotional connection? Like, what beat am I trying to make here? And how can I make it more just like grounded and smaller?
I'd love to move on to something that was extremely frustrating for Jonathan Glazer in making this. And that had to do with dialogue, because that is not what he was used to working with. He was used to working with any kind of visuals that he wanted. And then there would be voiceover somewhere. There would be music, you know, and he just never had to kind of bother himself with that. So he said, quote, "The visuals have always been key to my work. I've always been better at informing the audience through images than through words. But I took on a script that was so dialogue intensive that the words had to do all the informing and it was frustrating," end quote. And I thought that was something, you know, that perhaps a lot of people might not maybe anticipate when they're moving through different mediums to get to feature work or something, where, you know, you have this kind of appreciation of, you know, just the visual image. But at some point in time, there's sometimes where people have to talk.
Yeah. True. Very true. I feel him, man. It's like, for me, I am terrified of dialogue because, I mean, I'm not as much anymore as I used to be, but because I have such a strong obsession with realism. And when I hear something being read, where it feels read, it drives me crazy. But I think what I've really learned is, I mean, for my work, and it works really well in the stuff that I do. I'm not sure if it would for Sexy Beast, but by the way, like, I can't believe he even said that because it feels so effortless. Like, it's incredible, like, performances. But I usually just tell my actors to go off the script. I'm like, just don't worry about the words. Like, let's do another version where, you know, it's improv. And usually they'll stick pretty closely to the parameters of the script and get what you need. But like, it takes off the pressure of them reading it in their mind. And it's just really about what do I need to accomplish in this scene? What is my action? Like, what do I want in this scene? To me, it really helps with bringing a more natural performance.
Something I thought was really interesting, Ray Winstone said that they didn't change a single word in Sexy Beast.
Wow.
They came with exactly the script that he used, which is, it's interesting partially because I think that maybe some of that might have had to do with the fact that Glazer was at that time fairly uncomfortable with dialogue. And so deviating from that would mean deviating from his very kind of strict storyboarding of how he was going to shoot things and how they were going to look. So it seems like it probably would have, you know, been more of a frustration for him to even kind of do that. So he was just expecting his actors to come with that. But another trick that he was using, he said, quote, "I felt like I was shackled by a dialogue and plot, but I knew that going into it, that I had to be architectural about it and keep the second act absolutely angular. What I mean is the first act was supposed to be stupid. I tried to shoot it as if Ray Winstone's character had shot it, like of Holiday Snaps, just so simple. When his wife comes in, it's supposed to be curvaceous and fantastical. And when Kingsley shows up, it's supposed to be architectural, abrasive, and spare. In London, I felt I could actually move the camera and enjoy the paranoia of the camera a little bit more. I find redundant camera work really intrusive. So I was trying to follow, or I was trying to allow the words to do all the dancing. And for me, just to witness them, rather than track around the tables every 5 minutes, which is an easy temptation to fall into, end quote. I think that's, to me, that's a really kind of enlightening way to look at the way that he's shooting dialogue in that scene, because he is just kind of witnessing it. He isn't tracking the dialogue, you know, like you don't see him doing just like, oh, here's a reaction shot to this, here's a reaction shot to this. He's not just spinning around the table to get that. He's just kind of a voyeur in a sense. And if he doesn't catch the person who's talking on camera at that point, then it's okay, because he's still getting the rest of the scene.
I'm all about non-sync, because I'm a documentary filmmaker. So, you know, there's sometimes nothing you can do about that, like not having the person speaking when, you know, you're not shooting them. But I think reactions actually are so important for the architecture of the scene, and getting the actual like tone and the way that the room feels when these things are happening. Super important. Yeah, that's something I like actually have been like having a lot of conversations about, because I'm right now shooting a new documentary on a robot named Sophia.
Oh, that robot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen her.
I've been co-directing with my friend John Casby, and I like a few years ago I saw her on, I don't remember where it was, but she had just gotten her Saudi citizenship, and I was instantly intrigued and started just doing a ton of research and going into this crazy rabbit hole. And I ended up having a conversation with David Hansen, who's the man behind Sophia.
Okay. So, all right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's the person who's made Sophia. But like my first conversation with him I had was, you know, why are you doing this? And he said, I'm interested. I mean, that's the question. And he said, I'm interested in consciousness. And it was just unexpected that would be the answer. But yeah, we've been talking a lot about, with my editor, we've been talking a lot about sync and non-sync and like where you're putting the camera and how it relates to the scene.
Well, you may actually then have more in common with, you know, Jonathan Glazer's style than you perhaps thought otherwise, because it seems like you're working with the same idea of witnessing people, at least, you know, when they're speaking, when you're not, you know, trying to impose your own kind of visuals or directorial intent on things.
Yeah. Well, also his work, I mean, like the other film that he made, Under the Skin, it's very different. I mean, you can see the similarities, but his experimenting's really fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like I heard that like Scarlett Johansson, he had her just like drive around and talk to people on the street. And I like kind of experimenting with the way that you kind of, you know, bring your characters into the world. And I always do that. Like when Jaden Smith was in the Skate Kitchen, I had him go, you know, hang out with these kids from Queens for a week. So I was like, you need to understand where they're coming from, their world, like what their world's like, because it's very different than your world.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit further into that. But, you know, perhaps some of the casting choices, too. It's a cool movie. But we'll be right back.
Hey, you've reached Dr. Game Show. Leave your message after the beep.
Hello, this is Steve from Albany talking about my favorite podcast, Dr. Game Show. Dr. Game Show is a show where listeners submit their crazy ideas for game shows, and the two hosts have to play them, and they often bring in celebrities and small children to share in the pain and hilarity. At first, it might seem like Joe Firestone has a contentious relationship with listeners, but that is only mostly true. She actually really respects us. It's a lot like Lethal Weapon, where Joe is like, "Oh, listeners, you're all loose cannons. You're out of control." And we're like, "No, Firestone, you're too by the book. You've forgotten what it's like out there." And that's why I love the show.
Listen to Dr. Game Show on Maximum Fun. New episodes every other Wednesday.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Crystal Moselle from New York, and we are talking about Sexy Beast. So, you know, we were talking a lot about the dialogue in this and, you know, how it can be so cumbersome. But the thing is, it's actually, I think, you know, fairly good. I like the way that these characters are talking to each other. I like how they're a little bit oblique sometimes, and they seem to be in character. Like, I believe that they're thieves. I believe that they are gangsters. And I know, Crystal, you were really into one point that Ray Winstone's character, Gal, was talking to his wife.
I mean, he's so romantic. But he's kind of, he's this, like, romantic gentleman, but says this is, like, the most absurd shit. Like, he's like, "I love you like a leopard loves his partner in the jungle."
"I love you like a rose loves rainwater, like a leopard loves his partner in the jungle, like, I don't know what, like, I love you."
He knows it's ridiculous what he's saying, but he's trying to find something better than his leopard thing. But it's really just, he just loves her.
It's just so sweet. I mean, That's the kind of thing, too, and I think that dialogue also rings true with how Glazer was directing these characters, which is he's making them kind of animalistic. And, you know, it is almost like a predator-prey situation, because Don is the kind of big fucking lion who comes to the watering hole and scares all the other animals away, because he's just so much of a presence. And, you know, I like the idea that it's kind of a watering hole, because they're all gathered around this fucking pool in the desert, you know?
Yeah.
It feels like that. And so when you get a little piece of the dialogue, you know, of that dumb kind of silly romantic gesture, I think it all fits in. It feels like a complete circle, a complete picture to me.
Yeah. Also, something very interesting that is just that just made me think of is every character we get to see their vulnerable side. Even like, I think like every single one, you know, like the moment where Don's like, you know, talking to himself in the mirror, like about like what he said earlier. And he's like, he's almost like mad at himself for revealing his vulnerabilities to Gal. And then even like the other guy that, what's his name? The one that lets Gal go at the end. What's his name?
Teddy.
Yeah. I mean, Teddy, we, you know, get to see a very vulnerable side of him, even if it was just for a moment. But it's not just all like these guys like being tough guys. Like, we get to see the different, and there's like very, like each character has like something dynamic about them.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate. I mean, for you, a lot of time.
Is that something that's on your brain all the time when you're working on something? It's just like, did we show this character's vulnerabilities enough?
Absolutely. For me, in my work, I don't believe in antagonists. Like, I understand that somebody can be antagonizing, but just to say that somebody's bad and somebody's good doesn't, like, that's not life. So to me, it's when I'm in the writing process, it's important for me to like try to show as many sides to this person as possible. Like, mm-hmm. I think showing, like, I think we just went through, you know, we're I'm putting together a narrative right now. I can't talk about what it is right now, but
okay.
I think that there was a moment where I was like, wait, you know, we need to like find where their vulnerabilities. We need to find a moment where their vulnerabilities shows through. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important when you're telling a story, because everybody has them. That's life.
Yes. Yeah. And to even show just a tiny split second of where their cracks are. I mean, it's great just for narrative construction, mm-hmm. honestly. It makes your job easier, I think, when you're doing that.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the idea that any first of any project will present the same kind of growing pains, because Jonathan Glazer was, you know, again, like this was a very hard shoot for him, even though he'd done other things. And he said, quote, "As a learning curve, making this movie was the steepest, sharpest I could have. To be honest with you, sexy beast, I feel the same way after I made my first music video or made my first television commercial. I thought, okay, I can do this, but I need to step up to the mark. I need to know what the rules are. And in doing so, I can feel where I can improve," end quote. So it's kind of that the growing pains that get you again and again and again the second that you're trying to do something different. You know, like you think mm-hmm. you've mastered this art form and all of a sudden you're like, oh, well, this is hard again.
Absolutely. I was talking to one of the girls the other day about this. I was like, you know, because she's like, I don't know if I can do this because I've never done this before. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't remember what she was talking about. I was like, that's how I feel every single time I take on a new project. We never know what we're doing. Because it hasn't been created before. And we're, you know, obviously we get more experience so that we have more tools in our belt to try to figure things out. But it's always about like stepping into the unknown and just trusting it.
Are you ever surprised by the rules though? You know, like when you go into a new medium, like you went from features to a television series, like working with, you know, a cable channel. And I feel like there have to be completely different rules for that.
No. I mean, for me, it was like, it was more like, oh, I have more people to like help me write this thing. This is cool. But I can't do something unless I really feel it. And mm-hmm. unless it's something that feels like it's my voice. So I've really taken my time to make sure that I get to be able to create things that I feel and I instinctually can create, because I'm, you know, I get sent scripts all the time and I'm just not, I just don't feel like I can fully commit to something that I don't completely feel.
I like it when, you know, people kind of go on their own artistic paths, you know, as Glazer is doing. You know, he ended up doing a lot more, obviously, where he's working with quieter actors. But I did want to point out, this is, brings up to this point, something that he kind of learned to do and how to direct with his characters is that he specifically told, you know, the people in the scene who had the most power had a certain stillness about them. You know, he told them that if you have like the power in the scene, then you are still. And he said, quote, "I was trying to get Ben to be as still as possible through the entire film. He's got such an expressive face. You can't take his eyes off of him, but he needed to be still," end quote. And that, I think, is a really interesting way of conveying power in a scene, and something that he, you know, went to an almost extreme with, going into both Birth and Under the Skin. There's so much stillness. There's so much silence that he's playing with in both of those movies. And here it comes as almost like friction against the rest of the, you know, the palette. The color palette is like so candy colored and the music is so kind of raucous. And all of a sudden you have this character who is like, listens a lot and then, you know, springs into action. But his body is still almost constantly.
No, I think it's beautiful. I think stillness is one of the most beautiful things in films. And I think, you know, working on with Skate Kitchen and Rochelle Vinberg, who plays Camille, like she says so much with just, you can feel what she's thinking. And I think that's like also about like casting and really finding talent that says a lot more on screen than, for me, it's like the behind the scenes, it's so much about collaboration and connecting. And you know, Rochelle is a writer and I think will be a director one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I really just connected with her over her experiences and her story And with the show, I was able, I mean, it was really exciting to be able to expand the stories out further, because there's so much, like, there's so much rich material and so many, you know, I think right now with everything that's happening in the world and, you know, the issues of Me Too, and, you know, there's no better people to navigate it than a group of young women that are trying to change the game up.
The future is bright. So bright, because it's just going to be about 110 degrees on Earth. we're all going to be baking like Ray Winstone in the sun, and I can't wait. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful leather body. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Crystal, and for talking about your work and also enlightening us about your thoughts on Sexy Beast. And people can watch Betty how, when, where?
May 1st. It will be the first episode premieres in the United States.
And we should keep an eye out for this documentary on Sophia and then all these other projects that you're doing that you're not allowed to talk about. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoy your rental cat.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. We're going to start doing something a little different at the end of each episode. If you've already listened to a few of these, you know that we're giving a staff pick, a film directed by a woman, any woman, something for you to do with any of your extra free time. If you've got kids, maybe after they've gone to bed, if you've got pets when they're sleeping. So the staff pick for today is Kathryn Bigelow's Point Break. It's a fantastic film, and it's a heist film that is not a heist film. It's more of a buddy film and a friendship film than it is a heist film, in the same way that Jonathan Glazer's heist movie is much more of a romance instead of a heist film. So watch it, love it, tell me what you think of it, and you can also re-listen to the episode we did on it with Shaz Bennett a while back. And if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Cigarette. What? This? No, I'm not going to put it out.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.